Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Friday, April 4th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun show on the way for you today. It is another edition of the Final Four Fancast. I caught up with a fan or famous alum from every team in the Final Four. Well, not every team. Virginia, you guys, no one wanted to call me back. No one wanted to come on the podcast. No one wanted to give me 10 minutes for an interview. So Virginia fans, do not blame me because you will not have anybody representing you on this podcast. Blame the three or four people that backed out on me when I was trying to get them lined up. So before we get into it, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. Any rating, any interaction that you have with this episode, with this series, it will help. It will help us in the rankings. It will help us in the metrics. And this is the time of year where those rankings and those metrics really do matter. The higher we go, the happier my bosses are. The happier my bosses are, the happier I am. The happier I am, the better show you are getting. So really, giving me 5 stars and saying something nice about me is only going to make your day that much better. So I thank you for any of the help that you can give me, except for you, you UVA guys that didn't want to come on my podcast. Let's get into this. We are going to kick things off with former Texas Tech head coach Pat Knight. And now I'm thrilled to welcome on to the podcast former Texas Tech coach Pat Knight, who has great insight into, I guess, the development of Chris Beard back in his early days as a program. So, Pat, I appreciate your time, man. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.
So let me start you off with this. I don't know how much you've actually watched Tech this year, but I know you know that program, you know that school. Did you ever think that that program could get to the point where it is now? We're talking about ending a 14-year run for Kansas atop the Big 12. We're talking about getting to the Final Four. Did you think that this was something that could be done in Lubbock?
Yeah, I mean, we've got it. My dad and I mean, you know, when Chris came with us, you know, we got it going, I think, in the right direction. I mean, we beat Kansas, I think, 3 times at home and, you know, got to the tournament 4 times, NIT a couple times. And so, my dad was always big on, when he talked to the assistants about schools, they got to have a history. And so, you know, so they've had a history. You know, Coach Dickey had some really good years there, Gerald Myers. So, you know, it's always been there. And so there's always been groups of coaches, you know, to keep it going, and to get it in a good spot. So I think the potential is always there, but they just got kind of have to have the right guy that could carry it on and, you know, kind of get it over the hump. And, you know, and I think that's what Chris has done. I mean, he was the perfect fit, for them being assistant there for 10 years, you know, and so I think that's the type of guy it needed to be to get him over the hump and not some of the other guys they've hired in the past. It's just, you know, he was with us from the get-go, and we got things going in the right direction, and he knew what it took. And that was really the reason my dad's the one that really recommended him for the job. And so, and that was one of the reasons, because he knew the whole situation, the good and the bad of the job, because he was there for 10 years as an assistant.
Yeah, so you worked with him for 10 years at Texas Tech, right? So at what point did you – like, was there ever a moment where you're like, okay, this guy's got a future in this thing? Was there a moment you realized how good he was, or is this kind of sprung up on you? Like, what was the early days of Chris Beard at Texas Tech like?
It was good. You know, I was in charge of hiring. When my dad got the job, we needed a junior college coach. We'd already hired Bob Beyer, who's now at the Oklahoma City Thunder. And so my dad was like, you know, we're going to have to be half and half. Cause my dad didn't want to go through a whole total rebuild of, you know, just high school kids. And so we actually, when my dad got the job, they had to wait a week to have the press conference. And so he actually got permission from the NCAA that he and I could go recruit, but we couldn't say we were going to Texas Tech. It was a strange deal. I couldn't wear any Texas Tech gear, but I could talk to kids about playing for Bob Knight. But and the only thing we could tell them was that there'll be an announcement in a week of what school he'll be. So do you want to play for Bob Knight? So I was at the University of Akron at the time, and I called because my dad was like, we need about 5 junior college guys. And so I called every school. Are there any good players available? So we get a list. My dad and I split it up. and they were all junior colleges through Texas and Kansas. And we actually took a week each, and I took like the West, he took the East, and then we met at Hutch for the championships. And so, but he was like, hey, on the way, when you're meeting with these guys, if you find a guy you think could work for me, you know, let's get him on campus and hire him. Well, I go through, you know, and didn't really find anybody. Well, he calls after me because Chris had a big kid we were trying to recruit at Seminole, and he was like, hey, I'm going to bring this kid on campus, but I want you to handle it. And, you know, you make the decision. You know, if you think he can work for us, hire him. And so Chris came on campus because his player was coming on for a visit. We had, like, I think five kids on visit that weekend when they had the press conference for my dad to become the coach. And so I was in charge of Chris, taking him around, and we hit it off. I mean, I knew right then just because he could work for my dad. And so, so coach is busy, you know, with all the, you know, getting hired. I mean, this is the weekend he gets hired, so he's busy. And so Chris really doesn't see coach. And so I just tell him, I was like, hey, you got the job. And he's like, well, what do you mean? I was like, you got the job. I was like, I'm in charge of making the decision. You know, coach likes you. So I was the final say. I was like, do you want to come? He was like, yeah. Well, there's no contract because coach is busy. And so, you know, this poor guy's got a family and everything. And I was like, well, you got to understand, coach's word is his bond. You know, he's one of those few guys you can trust. But I'm telling you, you're hired. So this guy, he doesn't know what to do. And I forget if he went home for a day or two or didn't. And then his family came. But we had to get to work, you know, recruiting. So he just pretty much worked without a contract for a month and just trusted in coach that, you know, he was going to end up being hired officially. And I think after a month, he finally got his contract and signed it. But it was kind of funny how things went. He just kind of jumped in blindfolded and trusted that coach would eventually get him his contract. And that's how it started. So I kind of knew from the start, because we just couldn't hire anybody, you know, to work for coach. And so I kind of knew from the start, this guy has what it takes.
Yeah. I think what makes him so special is the way that he can develop a culture and develop a bond with the guys on his team, and that he could do it so quickly. I mean, what he did at Little Rock, with I think they had 10 new guys, and immediately turns them into a 30-win team. You look at this year, they lose six of their top eight scorers. They got two grad transfers coming in, and boom, you got a team in the Final Four, won the Big 12 Conference. What is it about him that makes him so good at getting kids to fight for him and to play hard for him and to listen to him and to kind of do what he asks them to do?
Well, he just has a good personality. You know, that's the bottom line. I mean, kids see through phony guys, and there's a lot of those type of guys, and the business, and he's just a genuine guy, and people can talk about culture and all that, and yeah, that's important, but the hardest thing to do is to get kids to play hard, and that's what they do. They play hard every single game, and so to me, that's the most difficult thing to overcome, is just playing hard, and I think that alone is all you need to talk about. If you see any coach and his team plays hard every game, then that says something about them, and that's what they do. I mean, they play hard.
Mm-hmm. So last year at the regionals, this is actually so this story kind of puts in perspective the way that I look at Chris Beard. So last year at the regionals, after they beat Purdue, we were in a back hallway, and I think he was getting interviewed by Andy Katz, right? And they were about to get ready to go play Villanova. Obviously, Villanova's coached by Jay Wright. And Chris had never met Jay, and he had asked Andy to introduce him to Jay just so he can make the connection, because I know he has a lot of respect for the way that Jay kind of coaches and that Jay went with the four ball out. Like I talked with him about that last year. And this year, I think it was yesterday, he talked about how he called Tom Izzo to tell him who he was and tell him the way he loved the way he played, loved the way he coached, all of that kind of stuff. And I think with a lot of guys in coaching, when you hear stuff like that, it can come off as maybe shallow or maybe as an act and something that they're just trying to put on so people will buy a way that they carry themselves. And it doesn't feel like an act with Chris. It feels like that's genuinely who he is, right?
Yeah, I mean, he wants to meet the guys. And you know, if he hasn't met them, he's got respect for what guys have done in the past. You know, I don't even see that. You know, it looks shallow at all. It's just a guy that is showing great, you know, to me, showing great respect, and that's what he is, just a personable guy.
So, give me your best Chris Beard story from back in the day.
Well, the problem is we can't talk about a lot of, we had a, when I took over, we had a guy, we were in Dallas, and you know, we're going out night before a lot of time, and so we get up, and of course, you know, I do the old head coach deal. I sleep in the front seat while he has to drive, and we had to go to like three or four high schools and get up at the crack of dawn, and so he is starving, hungry, and so I was kind of always notorious for I didn't eat a whole lot, and it drive those guys nuts, and so he finally pulls into McDonald's, and I wake up, and he orders his deal, and so it comes my turn, and I kind of mess with the person at the drive-through, using, you know, starting some words with Mick, but added something to it. Well, I really can't say what I said, but it's enough that they wouldn't serve us. So Chris is just pissed at me, you know, because he hadn't eaten. He's driving me to these places, hadn't slept. So we stopped. We stopped like at a gas station, get some blueberry muffins. And so I don't think anything of it. So we go to this high school, and he's just like right up on me, like behind me, not on the side of me, not walking in front of me, but like up behind me. And I don't know what's going on. So we meet, you know, you go to high schools, you meet, if there's an AD, meet the AD, meet the principal, vice principal. We get with the coach. Finally, after we meet everybody, they kind of leave the gym, and they're about to start their workout. I turn around, I was like, dude, what are you doing? Why are you all up behind me? He's like, you got blueberry muffin all over your ass. And I'm like, what? And I turn around because it's been a long night. I had blueberry, I mean, smeared across my whole backside. And he protected me because he didn't want me to get embarrassed and just ran block on us. I'm meeting the principal, and Chris is standing behind me. And it keeps kind of like moving me. And no one ever knew that I had a blueberry muffin stuck on my ass. And he protects me. Then he takes me, makes me go. So we have like three more high schools. He's like, man, you are going to the mall right now and buying a pair of shorts. He takes me to some mall, and we're some, you know, nowhere place in Texas. He takes me into some place like the Gap. Makes me, he's great. He's waiting outside the dressing room. I find a pair of shorts that fit. I hand him the ones with blueberry all over them. He takes them, throws them away. And we ended up going to the rest of the high schools, and I had clean shorts on. But we had all kinds of – he always brings that up. He loves telling the blueberry story to people. And so we had a bunch of times like that. And, you know, we always had a good time, not just working together, but hanging out. And, you know, I wish those kind of stories that, you know, I could tell you in private and you'd get a kick out of. But he was just always fun, man. We had a great time together. And you know, we still do, but – you know, we worked together for 10 years, and it wasn't like we were co-workers. You know, it was like we're brothers. You know, it was just a really good time because, you know, he's a personable guy, good storyteller, and we just have a lot of fun together.
All right, last thing I got for you is I'm good friends with Jeff Goodman, and I'm always looking for dirt on him. So if you have any embarrassing Jeff Goodman stories, please feel free to share them now.
No, you know, I really don't. That's the funny thing. Jeff has never had really the guts to really hang out with us, so we just get some dirt on him. You know, it's always been on the phone and in a nice situation, and we begged him to come out with us a few times, and so I wish I could. I mean, but right, he's just been super nice and a great guy all the time, but we've never gotten him to come out so we could get some dirt on him, but we're still hoping that happens. You know, we still anytime I run into him, you know, I'll try to get him to go out, but he's never had the experience of being able to take him out. So I wish I had something to tell you, but I don't.
Well, I got plenty of dirt on him. So if you ever need it, you just let me know. I'll give you Jeff Goodman stories if you give me Chris Beard stories.
Oh no, that's no problem, man. Well, we'll have to get together and do that.
Well, listen, Pat, I appreciate the time, man. And I guess guns up, right?
Well, you see, this is the funny thing. To tell you how much I really like Chris, I'm actually rooting for a team, for a school that fired me. So as a coach, that's the hardest thing to do. So that's what cracks me up. You know, I didn't really leave there on, I didn't leave there on great terms, but I love him so much. I'm actually probably one of the few coaches you can find that is actually rooting for a team that fired him. So that just tells you what a good guy he is.
Well, there you go, man. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Take care.
And now let me welcome on to the podcast former Michigan State Spartan and current Chicago Bull, Denzel Valentine. Denzel, how you doing, sir?
Man, I'm doing well. Can't complain. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. Final Four, favorite time of the year. You know how it is, man. So let me ask you this. I know you've been banged up a little bit this year and a little bit this season. So how's the ankle doing? How's your health doing? Are you back to being healthy yet? Are you ready to go? Update me on all of that.
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. I just rehabbing right now, trying to get my ankle back right. It was a big disappointment not playing this year, and you know, having to sit out a year. But you know, I think I benefited a lot from it. You know, I got to get my body right, my mind right, and you know, get another year on my contract in the Bulls. So I was able to do that. So just trying to get back healthy and come have a great year next year.
All right, so let me ask you this, man. What is it about what Tom Dizdo does and the way that he coaches that allows him to set his guys up for success in the league and specifically players like you to get to the NBA when maybe recruiting rankings or it wasn't necessarily a surefire thing that you were going to be an NBA player when you got there?
I just think his development as far as, you know, developing people's work ethic, developing their game, the fundamentals, you know, just instilling that fire and that passion, you know, into each one of his players. You know, I can go down the list of things that he does for his players. He just, you know, kind of evolves you into a man, you know, off the court, you know, and on the court. And I think that's why I was able to be so successful is because, you know, he worked on a lot of different things to help me out to get to the next level.
Matt McQuaid and Kenny Goins, they were freshmen when you were a senior, right? And over the course of the last 3 years, they've turned into two of the better players on the team. And in my opinion, you know, two of the more valuable and more important players in all of college basketball, period. And if I would have told you when you were a senior, when you were watching them play as freshmen, that Kenny Goins was out here banging home game-winning threes in the Elite Eight to beat Duke and Zion Williamson, and you know, Cueto was out here turning into a lockdown defender that was guarding the opposing team's best perimeter player based off of what you saw from them as a freshman. Is that something that you would have believed?
You know what? I would believe it because when they came in, Kenny, I'm starting with Kenny first. Kenny, he showed me a lot. He came in, he was ready to work, he was ready to go. He was never scared. He always competed every day, you know, starting from day one, even in open gyms and throughout his freshman year. He was on the scout team and, you know, he was balling that year. So, you know, I saw the potential. It was just a matter of fact if he got the opportunity and if he was going to, you know, continue to want to grow and become, you know, a better basketball player. And, you know, that's what he's been doing. He's just been getting better and better each and every year. So it's no surprise, you know, he's a good kid and he works hard. So that's no surprise. And Matt, you know, the same thing. You know, he was making big shots freshman year. I called him Big Shot Cueto. That was his nickname I gave him. So his freshman year, when we played Kansas at the United Center, he hit two big threes to pretty much end the game and had a big defensive stop on Frank Mason there late in the game. So that's no surprise. I knew he had that in him. It was just a matter of fact of, like Kenny, you know, just getting the opportunity and keep working hard. Those guys are great guys, high character guys, and it was only a matter of time.
So you've played a couple years in the NBA now. Do you think that, I mean, everybody sees what Cassius Winston does at the college level, and I think that you know, obviously the way that he sees the game, the way that he reads the game, the way that he can pass is stuff that is very difficult to teach. But he's also not a guy that has maybe the physical tools that you would expect out of an NBA point guard. So how do you think he can translate to the next level, and do you think there is a future for him in that league?
I think so. I think he can come into the league and be a very solid player. I think what he's doing in college right now is definitely going to transfer out. Like you said, he's not the best athlete. You know, he's not going to give you that wow factor that, you know, Zion or, you know, R.J. Barrett or some of those other guys may give you. But Cash is going to come in. He's won it at all levels. He's won a state championship in high school. He won an AAU level, and now he's winning at the college level. So I can see a transfer, man. He just does too many good things on the court, shooting, passing, and he has that it factor. He just wants to make the game winning shot, you know, to help his team win the game. And you know, I think at any level that could transfer.
The other thing about Tom Izzo that I don't think people realize is, you know, Michigan State has this reputation for being a tough defensive team and a tough rebounding team and pounding people on the glass and big and physical, and they do all of those things. But for my money, I don't know if there is a coach that teaches the fast break and the transition game better than Tom Izzo does. And you were in it, man. You were in the point for him. What is it about the way that he coaches and the way that he wants his team to play that you're constantly able to peep people down the floor? Like against Duke, I don't know how much of the game you saw, but they got two layups off of transition, off of made free throws, and that's just not something that you see very often at all.
Yeah, I mean, we practice it every day, called the war drill and the three-man break. I don't know if they still do it. You know, they probably still do, but you know, we started practice off with that every day, just transition, ball out, get it up quick, run in. And then that was for the three-man break. And then for the war, you know, that was, you know, 5-on-5. You box out, team gets the rebound, and it's a transition. So try to get out as fast as you can. And so, you know, they work on those things every day. So it's me.
Your brother is on staff, or was on staff at Loyola last year when they made the Final Four. You've also played in a Final Four. So what is it, maybe when you came to the event as a fan, that was, I mean, obviously the experience was different, but what was it about the experience that maybe you didn't realize was happening when you were kind of the player that was going through all of the dealing with having to talk to us media guys all the time and having to deal with everything that came with being, you know, a player in an event like this? Was there anything that opened your eyes about being the fan and going through that whole experience? Was there anything different?
No, I think as a fan, it was a much different experience. Like you said, you know, I got the experience going around the city, how many fans that, you know, from each school and from around the country supporting their school. And also realizing how big the Final Four is with traveling and the airports going into San Antonio last year were bananas. You know, the drive-in, you know, the city is bananas. And then, you know, you go into the hotel, you kind of in it. It's just amazing to see all the fans up in their schools and, you know, just it's just energetic, you know, place for, you know, to celebrate college football, you know, the last weekend. So it's definitely a fun event.
What was more stressful, being a player in the Final Four or being the fan watching your brother coach in a Final Four?
Probably the fan, to be honest, because you can't do nothing about it. So it's like you just got to sit there and, you know, just hope for the best and pray for the best. And as a player, I was more anxious and I was just having fun. So definitely more, as a fan, more nervous.
All right, so the last thing I got for you, Denzel. I know Dame Fife well. Obviously, you know Dame Fife as well. And I need your best Dame Fife coaching story, your most embarrassing Dame Fife coaching story. Just give me something good about Fife that you can tell us on the podcast. Hopefully it can be just PG-13, you know, because this is a family podcast. But, yeah, I need your best Dame Fife story.
Fife story. Let me think of a Fife story. We got into it after the Michigan game, my senior year, because me and coach was barking back at each other, and you know, we kind of got into it when we got back at like late at night that night. But that was probably the most crazy thing that's ever happened to Fife. I don't know, around me, I don't really have a lot of Fife stories.
was it he yelled at you after a loss? Do you not have a lot of Fife stories? You did not have a lot of Fife stories that you could tell on a podcast?
I mean, me and Fife was pretty much cool. Like, you know, we agreed on a lot of things. I mean, obviously we had our disagreements about certain things, but I don't really have no crazy. I'm not a really big storyteller, so I don't have a crazy story.
Well, then let me ask you this, because so you mentioned that you guys kind of got into it a little bit, and there was like this whole thing about Tom Izzo, and there was like a clip that went viral of him yelling at Aaron Henry. And I think the unique thing, and I kind of took Izzo's side on this one, because I think the unique thing about that program and that staff and those players and Izzo and everything about him is that the relationship that they all have together, and the relationship that you guys all have, like, you can kind of go back at each other and kind of get on each other like that, right? Like, it's a very much, and tell me if I'm wrong here, because I'm seeing this from the outside, but very much a family atmosphere where you guys, when you get into that flow of competition, you kind of go back and forth and push back at each other. Is that fair?
Yeah. We definitely, you know, It's a very passionate and enthusiastic program. So, you know, with that, it's very emotional. So sometimes, you know, in the heat of battle, you know, things may be done and words may be exchanged, you know, that may not, from the outside looking in, doesn't look pretty. But at the end of the day, you know, coaches coach and he knows what he's doing, and he trusts and believes in his players, and you know, we believe in trusting them back, and you know, it's like a family. So sometimes, you know, you may say or do things to your family member that maybe looking back on it, you wouldn't have done, or that, you know, or in the player's perspective, that, you know, maybe you're mad right now, but you'll appreciate later. So, you know, I just think the relationships that coach builds with his players, and the way he cares, and the way it's a family atmosphere, I just, the state just super exceeds all that stuff, and makes some of the stuff that you see on TV like that okay at the end of the day.
Yeah, you know, some of the biggest arguments I've ever had in my life have come with certain family members of mine, so I totally understand. Exactly. That. All right, last thing for you, Denzel. Exactly. They're playing on Saturday. You got Texas Tech. Is Michigan State going to be cutting down the nets on Monday night?
I think we have a very good chance of doing that. I'm very confident in our team right now, and Coach Izzo and his abilities to coach, you know, the team. He's won a national championship before. We've been there plenty of times. We have experienced players. We got an All-American point guard, first team. So I'm fully confident in us winning the championship. So hopefully we go out and do it. And, you know, I'm just praying and wishing for the best of luck from them.
That's a very diplomatic answer. I like that. Listen, man, I appreciate the time. Thank you for coming on. You know, best of luck with your health. And I hope to see you out there again next season.
All right, bet.
And now let me welcome on to the podcast Taylor Hicks, an Auburn fan that you probably know from American Idol fame. So let me start you with this, Taylor. I understand you are now an actor. You are doing more Broadway stuff. So why don't you just fill everyone in on what you are doing now and where you are working and where they can find your stuff?
Well, I live in Nashville, Tennessee, Birmingham, and
I've been in the studio at Zach Brown's studio in Nashville for a good while now, and I'm going to release that pretty soon, a brand new album. I haven't done a brand new album in a few years. Also, I've got I'm doing a lead in a musical in Cerami, Georgia, which is about 35 minutes southwest of Atlanta, at the Cerami Playhouse. Really, really big regional theater in the South, and then a really cool way to kind of, you know, get my feet wet in the acting field as a lead. You know, I was on Broadway as a teen angel in Grease, but Cerami is a really, really neat community. Interestingly enough, a lot of the actors from The Walking Dead live here. You know, Walking Dead is filmed right outside of Atlanta, so. Really neat community, and I'm in the actual play Shenandoah, which was a movie in the late 60s. It was starring Jimmy Stewart, and it was an adaptation on Broadway in the late 70s, middle to late 70s. And I've just really enjoyed, you know, getting to learn how to really take on and tackle a lead role. And, you know, this is just... hopefully a small step in the right direction for bigger steps in acting.
So what's the biggest difference when you are doing something like Broadway, and I'm assuming you're singing in these performances as well. What's the difference between the acting side and you know, when you are on stage just performing and just singing? And you know, is there a difference in how you go about your process? Is there a difference in what the performance is? Like, take me through all of that.
Well, you can't really mess up too bad on when you're in live theater. You know, the room for error is really small, you know, compared to movies and film, which is, you know, a little bit easier, you know, going back. A live theater is, you know, you have to be on for a couple of hours and a lot of focus, but it's you know, it's a great way to learn. You know, I took the Grease role in New York for about 4 or 5 months, and then we took it on the road for 18 months. So I'm familiar with the way that musicals operate, how they work, and it's just been an interesting learning experience for me.
So you said you live in Nashville now. Nashville is one of my favorite cities in the world. And I gotta ask you. So my favorite place to go when I'm down there, I either go to Jack's for ribs or I go to Rippy's. So you got to give me your like two or three favorite places down in Nashville. You got to give me all the best little places to go to.
Well, I like going down to Broadway every now and then and just, you know, honky tonking. I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, the biggest attract. When I have family and friends come into town, they usually want to do that one night. And so it's that's always fun to do. You know, Germantown is always a neat area to walk around. You know, the Parthenon is amazing. You know, there's just so many things going on in Nashville, and you know, I'm lucky to have the entertainment, you know, industry be there. And you know, I've lived in New York and LA, but I feel like Nashville's home. I feel like they can understand the way I talk a little bit better. And there's just a lot to do, and I'm really, you know, really happy to be a resident up there. I've been up there in and out for about 20 years now.
All right, so obviously you kind of rose to fame on American Idol. I want some stories from back then. You know, is Simon Cowell really as much of a jerk as he comes across, or is this kind of an act that he puts on, a quote-unquote brand? What did you think of, like, Paula and Randy? A little bit of both. Does Randy call people dog everywhere in real life, or is that just on TV?
Yeah, he's probably, like, a lot of those people that you see as judges, I mean, you know, they really are how they are, you know. If it's not broke, don't fix it. I mean, obviously,
right,
something's working. They need to be on television. But, you know, Simon's had a lot of experience in the music business and the industry. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to be the nicest in the world. But I think that's his shtick. And, you know, people enjoy that. And a lot of people don't really get to, you know, if you look at the country as a whole, you know, a lot of people don't really get to run into that crazy old British guy, you know, and I think that's what, you know, it allows that interest level, is because, you know, people from the hither end and parts
of the country where I come from don't necessarily get to run into your, you know, someone from other parts of the world, you know, and especially this old crotchety British guy. So I think it worked. I think it worked when I was on Idol. And, you know, he is a nice guy, sometimes.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about this Auburn basketball team. And you know, obviously you went to Auburn. You're a fan. I've seen you tweeting about them. So just talk to me about watching this team play, the Bruce Pearl era. Did you ever think that you'd be in a situation where you are sitting here getting ready to watch the Auburn Tigers play in the Final Four?
Well, you know, I was in school when they had Chris Porter, and they had a really, really great team.
Yeah, that was a good team.
In the late 90s. That we all thought that were, you know, I think that they were number one in the country for a while. And, we've had a little bit of a taste of that about what a team could do and what a team was supposed to do. This team really, you know, was everybody had their eye on, but nobody really thought that this team could get to the Final Four.
And I think that it's been, I've always thought that if the guard play, if the shooting were, if the shooters could shoot and had some good looks at the basket, I mean, these guys are really good three-point shooters. I don't care how you slice it, you know, you got to have great guard play in the tournament. Great
yep.
guard play in the college men's basketball tournament is the most important factor. You can have all these big guys, you know, and I think that there's a lot of debate on that. I don't think there is a debate. I think it's obvious. I mean, you have to have great guard play to go deep in the tournament. I mean, great defense, obviously, but you have to, you know, you have to have great guard play. And I think this is what's happened with Auburn.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. I got to ask you about Bruce Pearl. So you watch him on the sidelines. You watch him dancing around. You watch his mannerisms. I think that he probably would be a pretty good actor. He can make the different facial expressions. He's very emotive. Do you think that he would be able to play a role?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, if you look over the span of college basketball's, coaches over the years, you have to have those big personalities. And I think it's just obvious. I mean, you know, I grew up, you know, we have Wimp Sanderson and Calipari. And, you know, all of these coaches have these big, giant personalities. And I think that the team actually takes on the characteristics of the head coach. And I think you have to have emotion. You have to have a lot of emotion. I think you have to have more emotion in basketball that you can feed off of than you do football. I just think that Pearl has been a great example of that. And he exudes passion for the game. He exudes passion for his players. And I think his players feed off that, and I think you see a lot of that.
Yeah, I think his guys, you can tell the way that they play, he gets them to play hard for him. And that, I think that's the hardest thing to do when you are a coach, especially in a situation where, you know, a lot of these guys are, this might not be the end of their basketball career. Maybe if they're just playing a role, then maybe it hurts them professionally, whatever. But it's hard to, at the college level, always get your guys to play hard for him. And it seems like that's something that Bruce Pearl's really mastered.
The interesting part, I think, is going to be I grew up playing basketball, playing ball, and moving around to different tournaments. Going from Kansas City, a gym in Kansas City, which is smaller, to a brand new dome in the nicest, largest, one of the largest, you know, domes in the country. It's going to be interesting to see which team or teams, you know, shoot well. And mm-hmm. it's always tough getting out of the gates. And then that's something that you can see a little bit of the example of with Auburn in the SEC tournament and Auburn's first game in the NCAA. You know, once they got past the initial, you know, understanding of the gym, all of the sight lines, the range, you know, I think that's when you started seeing the comfortableness and the you know, the way that Auburn shot, they just gradually got better and better. And I mean, you know, before when they won this last game, I mean, they were shooting lights out because I think they're really pure shooters and they know the gym. I think that it's important to get this first game out of the way. And you've got to, you know, I look at it kind of like, you know, as much as there is going on around you, you know, when I was on that show, the one thing that I tried to do, and I mean, they were yanking all of us to do promotions. I remember doing Ice Age, the animated film for Fox. And I remember being pulled in all of these different directions. But the one thing that I did focus on is I focused on my music. I had headphones. I really didn't worry about a lot of the promotional aspects of being involved in something like that. And I think with Auburn, and if I don't know how you could do that, but I kind of place myself in the coaching hat, is that I would make sure that I would get my players on that floor and make them and let them get as comfortable as they can with as much time as they possibly could. Because I think that's gonna set them apart, is being able to shoot well in that dome.
So what's one thing about the process or the show or anything that happens with American Idol that you'd think that people that are not part of the show and haven't been involved with it may not know or may not realize?
Well, I think it's, you know, you only get 2.5 minutes of television, really. I mean, you know, that and that's what you have to really be focused on. I mean, there's a lot that goes on outside of your 2.5 minutes. It's important that people understand that, you know, you would think that you would be rehearsing all day and stuff like that. I mean, you're really kind of bouncing around doing a lot of different things. You know, I think ultimately clearing music is interesting. I like to tell people stories of me picking songs that I wanted to perform on Idol. You know, we had to do a lot of clearance, you know, to publishers, you know, of some of these iconic songs. And it just so happens that some of these iconic songs are actually, you know, peace offerings in divorce hearings. So, you know, maybe Gordon Lightfoot had a song that he did that was a big hit or something, and he gave it away to his ex-wife. So clearing music is a very interesting thing on a show like that. And a lot of people don't realize just how hard it is to really clear a song to be performed on a show nationally like that.
All right, last thing I got for you, Taylor. I need your official prediction. Is Auburn getting this done? Are they cutting down the nets on Monday night?
I think if they get comfortable in the gym, I think it's going to be hard to beat their outside perimeter game.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say if they get comfortable with the rims, if they get comfortable up there in Minneapolis and they shoot well and they like it, they're going to be a tough team to beat.
Yeah, if Bryce Brown gets hot, there's not a lot of people that are stopping him.
No, and then the style of play. I mean, you know, it's an interesting style of play to get out of the fast break and not want to take it to the rim and rather pull up for an open three, but it makes sense. You know, I mean, those shots, a lot of your brain is trained in out on the break to, you know, to guard the rim closest, you know, to guard the rim and not necessarily the perimeter. So I think all that momentum shifts and the idea in your brain shifts all the way to, you know, all the way closer to the back basket. And Auburn doesn't play that way. It's a completely opposite mindset. They like to pull up and pop the three on the fast break, and I think that they've created space and they've created opportunities. And I think that if they can do that, you know, with this first game, I think, and they get comfortable, I think they're hard to beat. It's obvious.
Well, listen, Taylor, I appreciate the time. I'm glad everything is going well for you. And War Eagle, right?
Yeah, man. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.